The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Unfortunately, the big news from yesterday really was that terrible shooting at the congressional baseball practice. It happened really just as we were getting ready to go on air with the program. And the big thing that really stood out to me looking at that is watching it unfold was just how it really exposes the divisions and the hatred there within some parts of the United States. I remember when Joe Cox was shot, that MP, in the run-up to the Brexit referendum. Now, she was shot dead, which obviously makes that more serious than what we saw yesterday. But I just remember there being this sense of profound shock, and everything political just stopped. And people from across the political spectrum started saying things like, well, has our rhetoric gotten out of hand? Do we need to make some big changes in how we do politics? Now, that kind of sense of shock and just feeling that something was really wrong in the country didn't last all that long. But there was a definite pause in the rhetoric and what people were saying about each other. But this time, with that shooting of a Republican, Steve Scalise, senior Republican lawmaker, there was almost nothing. I got an alert on my phone just before the Trumpet Daily Radio Show began yesterday, just saying that there had been a shooting and that a senior congressman or senior Republican was involved. And to get an update, I went online. I couldn't really see any details on the news websites. It hadn't really made it to the news websites yet. It was that new. Most hadn't really had time to report on it. So I do what you always do when something's so new that it hasn't made it onto the news yet. I looked on Twitter, and sure enough, there were reporters giving details and there was up-to-date information there. But what really surprised me was just how full of vitriol it was so quickly. This event was so new that it hadn't even made it onto the news sites yet. The details weren't on the websites. But already, people were talking about how this guy had it coming because he was a Republican, how he deserved this because he was a member of the National Riflemen's Association. There was no pause, no let up, no respect, because this was a very senior member of America's democracy was shot at. I didn't really see people talking about, and the way they did after Joe Cox's death, that it was an attack on an MP or a congressman. It was an attack on all of us, an attack on our democracy. Just people going straight to, well, he had it coming. Now, these weren't necessarily famous people making these statements. I think some were. Some had that kind of verified blue tick next to their names. But just that there are people like that that were so quick to come out with those kind of statements, it shows the huge amount of hatred that is building in the West, in Britain, in America. Victor Davis Hanson published a great piece on that division this morning. It wasn't directly related to the shooting, but he was warning about the divisions in America, the hatred, and how the hatred of one group for another is leading to the nation's downfall. He writes, "The United States is currently the world's oldest democracy, but America is no more immune from collapse than were some of history's most stable and impressive consensual governments. Fifth century Athens, Republican Rome, Renaissance Florence, and Venice, and many of the elected governments of the early 20th century Western European states eventually destroyed themselves, went bankrupt, or were overrun by invaders." That is what's at stake with the divisions that we see today. The United States, he writes, is divided as rarely before. Half the country, mostly liberal America, is concentrated in 146 of the nation's more than 3,000 counties, in an area that collectively represents less than 10% of the U.S. landmass. The other half, the conservative red states of the interior of America, is geographically, culturally, economically, politically, and socially at odds with blue state America, which resides mostly on the two coasts. These two Americas watch different news, they read different books, listen to different music, watch different television shows. Increasingly, they now live according to two widely different traditions. Barack Obama was elected after compiling the most left-wing voting record in the U.S. Senate. His antidote, Donald Trump, was elected largely on the premise that traditional Republicans were hardly conservative. America, he goes a bit further down, he writes, America barely survived the Civil War of 1861 to 65, the Great Depression of 1929 to 39, and the rioting and protests of the 1960s. But today's growing divides are additionally supercharged by instant internet and social media communications, 24/7 cable news, partisan media, and the denigration of America's past traditions. He concludes his article writing that all Americans need to take a deep breath, step back and rein in their anger and find more ways to connect rather than divide us. He writes at the end, things are bad now, but our own history suggests that if we're not careful, they can get even worse. So he's warning here that the very survival of the United States is at stake. That's how big the threat is here. He makes some great points throughout that. And Andrew Miller wrote a very similar article in the January 2017 Trumpet. I didn't write the title down, actually, but it was something along the lines of a nation divided against itself cannot stand. And he writes that this ideological divide is now wider than at any point in U.S. history since the post-Civil War Reconstruction era ended in 1877. And again, he makes the same point that the Republican Party represents geography, rural America. The Democratic Party represents demography, urban America, the same kind of divide that Victor Davis Hanson was talking about, cities versus the countryside. And Andrew writes that the urban-rural ideological divide is more dangerous than the North-South divide that resulted in the war between states. America's metropolitan areas cannot secede from the Union like a state can. This means that unless something is done to heal the deep ideological differences in America, the protests and riots currently engulfing America's cities will only escalate. It appears more and more likely that this unrest will escalate into full-scale revolution and urban war. And when somebody shoots a congressman and on one side of that ideological divide and then many people, not all, but many or some on the other side of that ideological divide don't mourn, don't stop, don't really criticize. Well, then you're on the road to that kind of outcome, full-scale revolution, urban war. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, he's also talked about this dangerous division. And here's what he said about it in a Key of David show, I think it was about 5 years ago.
And if you're divided against yourself, it's going to come to desolation unless something is done. Something has to be done to solve this problem. You see, the gravest danger is not from the enemies without. It's from bitter division from within. That's the real problem. That's worse than all of them. Abraham Lincoln discussed the same problem just before America entered the Civil War. And through his leadership, they just barely did save the Union. And I think most of you know the history of that. Now, if you look at America today, you will find that they, I believe, are more divided than they were even in the days of Abraham Lincoln. We have serious division. Look at the foreign policy of this land and look at the two parties in America. And they have a bitter disagreement over how to conduct foreign policy toward Iran and toward Israel. And what about what constitutes marriage and family? They're bitterly divided about that. I mean, like I've never seen before in my life. How about the economy and our debt? They're just as profoundly and bitterly divided on that issue as well. So who's right and how are we going to solve our problems? Well, Jesus Christ said it would bring us to desolation. That's how dangerous it is. Notice Christ also talked about this same issue in Mark. It's almost the same words, but it's being emphasized by repeating it again because it's such an important subject. This is in Mark 3 and verse 24. And if a kingdom be divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. Now, a country divided against itself simply is going to fall. That's what he's saying. And a house divided against itself is going to fall.
That's a very powerful warning there. And so much of this division that we see, it's only become worse since Mr. Flurry gave that Key of David program, since he talked about it then. You know, that Victor David Hansen piece, it talks about some of the same divisions that Mr. Flurry does. It brings out, he talks about division in how we address the debt and how we try and deal with America's economic problems. He talks about immigration and about how America has given up trying to assimilate those that are moving to the United States and about how that is fueling division. He talks about states, state governments vowing that they're going to defy the federal government, division there. He talks about the division coming from education and about how much of education now is just about pushing this really radical left-wing agenda. But in that same Key of David program, Mr. Flurry also talks about the solution to this division, what it's going to take to fix just the violent division even that we're seeing more and more in our countries. Here's what he says about that.
Now, I've seen something here more deeply than I've ever seen it before. And I think we need to look at it more closely because God wants us to understand this. And I certainly understand it even better from what I saw this morning. Notice what Christ inspired a third time to be written in Luke 11, verse 17. But he, knowing their thoughts, said unto them, every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and a house divided against a house falls. It just falls if it's divided against itself. Every kingdom, he says, divided against itself is going to be brought to desolation and destruction. And a house divided against itself falls. It just falls. But here's what I think is so profound about this. If you look at it closely, that house where he's actually talking about the kingdom falls apart, but he shows you why it falls apart, because the house falls apart. It's divided. Or the families and the marriages, they're divided. And that's what causes the whole kingdom to fall into devastation and desolation. That's what he's saying. If the house is divided, or the home, the families, then so is the whole nation going to be that way. And the more our homes are broken up and the families fall apart, according to this biblical traditional family, we're going to have problems like that we just simply can't solve. Here, is the family is the backbone of any nation. Even the Chinese understand that, and they don't get it from the Bible. But a house divided against itself falls. A family divided against itself falls. It cannot stand. And that is the foundation of your whole country. And so God gives us a solution here. It's deadly division that has to be removed from the families, or it will never be removed from the country. And one, the real problem begins with the family, with marriage and the family. Three times Christ mentions that, inspires this to be mentioned, and that's the number of finality. And I think he just is saying indirectly, well, look, you have this warning, and if you don't listen to it, you're going to have a finality of your own country if you don't learn this profound and foundational lesson. This is serious. And you've never seen more family and marriage breakdown than what you've seen in America and Britain and in Jerusalem and that part and the Jewish state today. You've never seen a breakdown of the family like you've seen today. And even just a few years ago, the families were much stronger. I'm telling you, there are serious repercussions from that, and that's what Christ was telling us about this house divided. But who listens to Jesus Christ? Those were actually His own words.
So there is a solution to this, and that ties in very well to some of the things that we heard from Mr. Stephen Flurry earlier in the week in this program about the real repercussions that come from family problems, from family breakdown. Earlier in the program, Mr. Flurry talked about how the solution to this all revolves around turning to God. He talks about how Abraham Lincoln addressed the divisions in the Civil War by pointing the nation back to God, by giving thanks for America's greatness, for saying, well, look, we need to give credit to God for giving America all of this. And then here he was talking about how it all revolves around families, about getting our families sorted, so that there's not divided families but that then contribute to this divided nation. But how possible is that for our nations right now? What will it take for people to turn to that as a solution? Well, it ties right in really with another major piece of news from yesterday. And you'll have to bear with me a few minutes to see exactly how. But moving now over to Britain, Britain has generally, it's had three major political parties. There's the Conservatives, the major right-wing party, the Labour Party, that's the major left-wing party, and then there's the Liberal Democrats, who have generally come third in elections. Now, that's been a little less so in recent years with the rise of UKIP, the UK Independence Party, that wants Britain out of the European Union, with the rise of the Scottish National Party. But they're generally the third force, or have been, in British politics. They're a left-wing party. They tend to be maybe a little less socialist than Labour. And yesterday, their leader resigned, stepped down from leading that party after the election. And here's his resignation speech.
From the very first day of my leadership 2 years ago, I have faced questions about my Christian faith. I've tried to answer with grace and patience. Sometimes my answers could have been wiser. At the start of this election, again, I found myself under scrutiny, asked about matters to do with my faith. I felt guilty that the focus was distracting attention from our campaign, obscuring our message. Now, journalists have got absolutely every right to ask whatever they see fit. The consequences of the focus on my faith is that I have found myself torn between living as a faithful Christian and serving as a political leader. A better, wiser person than me may have been able to deal with this more successfully, to have remained faithful to Christ while leading a political party in the current environment. To be a political leader, especially of a progressive liberal party in 2017, and to live as a committed Christian, to hold faithfully to the Bible's teaching, has felt impossible for me. Now, I am a liberal to my fingertips, and that liberalism means that I am passionate about defending the rights and liberties of people who believe very different things to me. There are Christians in politics who take the view that they should impose the tenets of their faith on society, but I have not taken that approach because I fundamentally disagree with it. It is not liberal, and actually it's counterproductive when it comes to advancing the gospel. Even so, I seem to have been the subject of suspicion because of what I believe and who my faith is in. In which case, we are kidding ourselves if we think we yet live in a tolerant liberal society. And that's why I have chosen to step down as leader of the Liberal Democrats.
That resignation, or the way he resigned there, I think is really quite astonishing. He said he finds it impossible in modern Britain to be a Christian and live and lead a major political party. And he's exactly right when he says, well, this shows that we're kidding ourselves. We think we live in a tolerant society because we have absolutely no tolerance for really the Bible or for anyone who upholds even the slightest bit of biblical morality. And just to understand what's going on, I look a little at the type of Christian Mr. Farron is. He's not exactly the most outspoken. I mean, you heard a bit about him there. He's incredibly mild when it comes to putting his Christian views into politics. During the election campaign, his party spokesman said that he's changed his mind and no longer believes that abortion is a sin. He voted in favor of homosexual marriage when it came up in Parliament in 2013. So, now you'd have thought, really, that people would be fine with that in so many ways. Okay, he's a Christian, but he voted in favor of homosexual marriage. He was kind of hounded a lot in the election campaign about his views on homosexuality. He kind of eventually said that he did not believe homosexual acts were sinful. He supported the left-wing liberal orthodoxy on that. He's made all of those concessions to the left. He hasn't let anything of the Bible influence how he votes on things like homosexual marriage and etc. But that was still not enough. He was hounded by the press for not giving a ringing endorsement for homosexuality during the election campaign, and for the way he answered some of those questions. Even though, as I said, he voted in favor of homosexual marriage. That's still, that was still not enough for so many people. And in the end, he ended up saying, well, that's enough. I can't be a Christian, even in that kind of quote-unquote very mild way that he was. I can't be a Christian and a party leader. We see the same thing with the Democratic Union Party. Mr. Flory quoted from Tim Stanley's article in The Telegraph about this Northern Irish party and about how they've just been absolutely hounded because they don't all believe that abortion is fine. They don't all want to legalize homosexual marriage, though they're even kind of moving in that direction. Look at what happened in Britain last week. You can hang out with terrorists repeatedly, over and over again. You can even give speeches to an outlawed terrorist group that then has one of its members go on and commit a terrorist attack in the run-up to the election on the streets of Britain. And, well, that's fine. You can still get 40% of the vote and lead a mainstream party. Be a serious mainstream politician. You can accept money from Iran, one of Britain's biggest enemies. That's fine. That's normal. That's mainstream now. But if you're a little bit hesitant when asked a question about homosexuality, even if you voted in favor of homosexual marriage, well, you're an extremist. You've got no business leading a major party in modern Britain. That's the kind of crazy, crazy upside down position we're in modern Britain. And think back to what we just played in terms of from the Key of David program about the division, about fixing the division in our society, and about how the solution involves turning to God, repenting, giving him credit for our national invention, national greatness. The solution is fixing our families, of fixing the division within our families. And the only way to do that is to get back to how God says to run our families. That's the only way it will work. Well, how hard is it going to be to get Britain to accept that solution when you look at the situation that we're in? When it comes down to it, you support the left's homosexual agenda, but just maybe when you're asked a question or two about it, you kind of and ah a bit. Well, nope, that's it. We can't tolerate that. And now you can really see why Britain and within the left in America, it's very similar. Now, America, I don't think has gone so far in terms of just completely rejecting any semblance of biblical morality the way that we've seen Britain do. They have, I think, in certain circles, but they're certainly leaning that way. If you look at the way the law on homosexual marriage is being applied to try and force everyone to get on board with that and to support homosexual weddings and things, no matter what their own beliefs are. But I don't think they've gone quite as far in this direction as Britain has. But still, the trend is there in America, and you can see how much it's, you can start to see how much it's going to take before the nation as a whole is humble enough to turn to God, to accept his solution, to accept his way of running our families. And we've so completely embraced just this left-wing position on marriage, on family, on it, on just this whole agenda, that it's going to take a lot to turn the nations around. And this is one of the really enduring results of the of Britain's election last week. Beliefs like Jeremy Corbyn's, well, they've been normalized. They're normal now. Well, there's even they weren't just 5 days ago, 6 days ago, ahead of the election, they were rejected. Meanwhile, Christianity, well, that's what's extreme now. And even a Christianity that says, well, I privately believe that homosexual marriage is wrong, but I'm going to vote for it in parliament, or Tim Farron didn't even go that far. But even that kind of Christianity now is too extreme for Britain today. And it really is astonishing how quickly Jeremy Corbyn has moved to the mainstream. I mean, to be fair to many of the newspapers, did bring attention to some of the extreme things he said and done ahead of the election, though really the BBC crucially did not do enough of this, and that's where I think the majority of British people get the majority of their news. But many in the newspaper, at least before the elections, they were talking about how extreme Jeremy Corbyn was. Even his own party disliked him. Just last year, 172 out of his 229 members of parliament, an overwhelming majority, supported a no-confidence vote in his leadership. The vast majority, nearly all, thought he was too extreme to be leader of the Labour Party. They tried to get rid of him. They supported that no-confidence vote in his leadership. And now they're embracing him. Just a few days later, just a few days after that election result. This is a recording of how Jeremy Corbyn entered Parliament for the first time since the election a couple of days ago. And unfortunately, there's no recording from the actual House of Parliament itself, House of Commons itself. But you can hear the commentators talking about it.
Oh, look, there's Jeremy Corbyn.
And Jeremy Corbyn entering the House. And a lot of applause.
Looks like he's getting a standing ovation.
And I think Theresa May is also in the chamber, having left the talks at Downing Street.
I think so.
A lot of standing applause. Yeah. And that was not something that Jeremy Corbyn got in the run-up to the election, shall we say.
That's not at all what Jeremy Corbyn got in the run-up to the election. Just a few weeks ago, just before, in Parliament before that election, this is how he was typically received by his own supporters. Now, that's a bit of a dramatic representation. Obviously, there aren't quite that many crickets in the House of Commons. And maybe it's a mistake now to give our producer that soundbite, because he'll play it every time I tell a joke now. But that was the general effect that you got. You could see it on the videos. His own party members generally would just sit there with their arms crossed when normally you would expect them to be applauding and cheering their leader. You know, they were all against him. They believed he was too extreme for the Labour Party, and now they've embraced him. Now he walks in and they give him a standing ovation. And this is part of an upsurge in the far left movement worldwide. It's going to have an impact everywhere. It's going to affect America. Actually, I saw an article in the New Statesman this morning talking about how people from Bernie Sanders' campaign came over and played a major role in Jeremy Corbyn's campaign. I think some, at least, volunteered to come and help Jeremy Corbyn. And they were giving training to grassroots movements, to supporters. Coming over from Bernie Sanders' campaign, campaigning for Jeremy Corbyn. It's all part of that same movement. Bernie Sanders, he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. He wrote, the British election should be a lesson for the Democratic Party. And you can be sure next time primaries come, it seems like there's always primaries going on in America. I guess they're probably just months away. I don't know. It seems like as soon as one election's over, the next one starts. And once that does get underway, you can be sure you'll hear a lot about this from Bernie Sanders' supporters. Maybe they'll have a different candidate this time around. He seems like he's getting quite old for trying to run for president. But they'll be talking about, well, Jeremy Corbyn did really well. He had a position more extreme than Bernie Sanders, further left than Bernie Sanders. And he got 40% of the vote. That's what they're going to be saying. After the election, the hashtag Bernie would have won was trending on Twitter. And maybe those Bernie Sanders supporters are right. It's certainly going to have an impact on the far left in America. And it's the same all around the world. Australia's Sydney Morning Herald, they had an article talking about how he could well be empowering the far left in Australia. That article stated the result shocked all the parties and signals a realignment of British politics to the left. And that's exactly right. Robin Archer, a London School of Economics political scientist, says the election feels transformative. This article goes on to say Corbyn's experience will present Labour in Australia with two temptations. The Labour left here will argue that the party can win over many more young voters with a more generous redistributive policy offering. More generous redistributive policy offering. In other words, communism, socialism, paid for by soaking the rich and perhaps allowing the deficit to blow out. Again, just learning from his, forget about the economy, forget about the debt. Just keep spending. Keep spending at the same kind of rates that we were during World War II. On massive social programs. In short, to bring back class warfare. The Corbyn experience will also be used by allies of the left faction's Anthony Albanese to put him forward as the candidate of authenticity, in contrast to the scripted Labour leader Bill Shorten. I'm not really an expert on Australian politics, but you can see absolutely how those in the left of the Labour Party in Australia are going to draw on Jeremy Corbyn's success and say, well, look, we need to copy his positions all around the world. When you get a far left candidate where people would have said, well, no, he's too extreme, he can't win, people are going to say, well, look at Jeremy Corbyn's shock performance. Look how well he did. Yes, he can. He can win. Look how well he did over in England. And this is not something that's going to go away. Jeremy Corbyn, he got massive support from the youth vote. I had an article up on the website earlier this week talking about that. Just how enthusiastic Britain's young people were to Jeremy Corbyn. And what's going to happen as time goes on, you're just going to get more and more of this generation voting, supporting the left wing. I saw, we talked about this on the Trumpet Hour yesterday, so I don't want to get into it with Mr. Hillicker in too much detail, because you can go back and may well have already listened to that show. But it was some of the graphs and the data were just astonishing. I saw one that showed, okay, for the last 20 years or more, the young, they've been slightly more left-wing generally than the old, maybe about 10% more Labour-leaning than average compared to being conservative-leaning. And then just in the last 2-3 years, that difference has just exploded. Now the 18 to 24-year-olds, they're 50% more likely to be left-wing than average. Then all of those age groups, 25 to 34, they've dived to the left as well. Not quite as extreme as the 18 to 24, but they're further left too. And it's just the Labour leadership here has just seemed like they've managed to capture a whole generation. Here's John McClure, he's a lead singer of, I guess, some band, talking about the support for Corbyn that he's seen as he's been going round and campaigning for him.
I travel all over this country playing me gigs and stuff. Kids love him, young people love him. Not one tweet, not one Facebook post on the Conservative Party encouraging the youth to vote, because they know that the overwhelming majority of young people are starting to listen to Corbyn. And when I had him on stage, there were 20,000 people singing his name. And that's not, and I just think that now this election's over, we really need to, give him his dues, because there's been an incredible smear campaign. I'm a massive fan. I think that he offers something that we've not seen in British politics in my lifetime, perhaps even. We've never had a left-wing government or a party that's pushed a progressive agenda like this, and I think he's a great fella.
Never had a left-wing government. We had, I don't know, 10, 12 years of Tony Blair. That was a really left-wing government. You know, sometimes we have, at Edstone, we have quite a few Americans over here, and they often talk about how much more left-wing, how much more socialist, how much more statist, government interventionist the country is than America, and they're absolutely right. But then sometimes I just tell them, well, this is under a conservative government. I remember what it was like under Tony Blair, and it was way worse, even to the point... It was all over. You'd have people going through bins trying to, the government was snooping through people's bins, I think, at one point, trying to enforce recycling policies or even doing that and so they could send them health advice. The Conservatives haven't done a huge amount to roll back that left-wing agenda, but even Tony Blair, it was quite a left-wing government, nowhere near as far left-wing as Jeremy Corbyn. But we did have that experience with the left just very recently. But apparently that's all forgotten. But one of the things when I was looking into that article that we've got on the Trumpet about how on the Trumpet website about how left the younger generation are and about how they've really tapped into the young people. One thing that stood out was just how shallow some of the reasonings were for voting for Jeremy Corbyn. There are some things that I can kind of sympathize with to a certain extent. Look, he's talked about getting rid of student loan debts and getting rid of tuition fees. And then you can see from a self-interest point of view, if somebody tells you, you vote for me and you are going to be, US dollars, when you include interest, it's probably something like $70,000-$80,000 better off because you're going to be able to go through university for free or without these massive students, without having to pay tuition fees. I can see why that could be tempting. I mean, it's basically saying I'm going to give you $80,000. If I win, I'm going to give you $80,000. Yeah, I can see why that could get a lot of votes. But then some of the reasons are just so shallow as well. Somebody, The Guardian, was talking about how Jeremy Corbyn, a big factor in his popularity was his meme ability. That you could easily make memes to spread on social media about him. I imagine trying to explain that to politicians of generations past. How did you end up with this left-wing socialist leader who hangs out with the nation's enemies? Oh, well, he was very memeable. The article also talked about how cool he was and about how a big factor in his popularity is just his coolness. Here's a clip of one of his interactions with a large group of young people that really went viral and spread very far on social media. That I think it illustrates the appeal of this kind of coolness.
Jeremy, okay, guys.
Jeremy, you're the Pringles.
Yes, I'm a Pringle, sir.
There's a few here.
Yeah!
Jeremy!
You did very well, Jeremy. Well done.
Can I say massive thanks to all of you for being here today? It's changed the whole atmosphere. Do you know, during the leadership contest, we had a rally outside the church here. And we're back home again. Listen, we've got 8 days. Get out there.
We got you, B.
Have those conversations with everybody about the kind of society we can be and the kind of world we can live in. It's ours to win on June the 8th. Is that okay? Yeah!
We will. We will.
That's not some kind of rational calculation of, well, I don't really like his terrorist sympathies and some of these things, but he's going to make me way better off because he's going to get rid of tuition fees. therefore I'm going to hold my nose and vote for him. It's just a full-blown enthusiasm. But that Pringle moment, it was, you know, there are articles talking about how this was the turning point of the campaign. People were voting for him because he ate a Pringle. I mean, do you have Pringles in America? Okay, good. I'm getting the thumbs up from Sam. Even after having lived in America for 5 years, I'm still get amazed by expressions that aren't used over there, and kind of have these moments where I'm like, what? Every time I've used that, none of you have any idea what I've been talking about, and it's taken you this long to tell me that. Anyway, he ate a Pringle, and that became this big moment of the election campaign. It's just been full in terms of the young people turning out for him, of just these really shallow moments. And we've talked a lot. I have, Mr. Flurry has, on this program, of just, you know, how extreme he is. But look at the support he has from young people. That's the future. While Tim Farron, while someone who is a little reticent in voicing their support for homosexuality or homosexual marriage, well, they're too extreme. Now, just as we finish up this section, here's some quotes from an article Mr. Joel Hilliker wrote, which I think it's about 7 years ago now. 7 years ago, called Welcome to the Upside Down World, or The Upside Down World. And that is exactly where we live when you see these kind of results. He writes, it's a world where truth is trashed and lies are lauded, where the honorable are despised and the depraved are empowered, where sound morals and strong character are relentlessly mocked, while immorality is praised, paraded, and protected. Isn't that exactly what we've seen over this last week? He then quotes from Melanie Phillips' book, The World Turned Upside Down. Self-evident common sense appears to have been turned on its head, writes Melanie Phillips. Self-designated victim groups have turned right and wrong victim and aggressor inside out. Their right not to be insulted or discriminated against in any way has become the basis for discrimination and injustice against the representatives of majority values. Nothing is really as it is meant to be, she writes. Society seems to be in the grip of mass derangement. Has the world gone mad? And then that article, Mr. Hilliker quotes Isaiah 5, verses 20 to 21, which states, woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. And Mr. Hilliker writes, he couldn't possibly have described the upside down world with more penetrating precision. And that's exactly true. That's the upside down world we live in. We'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll have just a few minutes to talk about one more news story.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
That was a pretty epic soundtrack on that ad in the break. We need that going the whole time. I'd sound really eloquent and dramatic with that going behind me. I think anyone would. Anyway, welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. While we've kind of been looking or very focused on the dramatic developments in Britain, in America, there have been some notable developments in Europe as well that have received probably less attention than I think they would have done had they occurred while less was going on around the rest of the world. I've kind of all been looking the other way. Some of Spain's biggest banks have been getting into huge trouble. Last week, Banco Popular, it's one of Spain's biggest banks, it basically failed. It had to be taken over by Santander, who bought them for, I think, 1 euro. It was, a rescue the government had to put together and work with Santander on. And whenever you have a big bank fail, of course, people start looking nervously around, saying, well, is this going to be another Lehman Brothers moment? I think it says a lot about the state of the euro that still, what are we, nearly 10 years on, nine years on or so from the euro crisis, you're still having major European banks failing. And when that happens, you're still having people kind of looking nervously around and saying, well, is this the start of the big earthquake? And I think they've breathed a bit of a sigh of relief so far from Banco Popular. There are still other banks all across Europe now that are pretty questionable. The Times wrote earlier this week, two of Spain's weakest lenders were the focus of investor panic this weekend, raising fears of another Spanish banking crisis. They talked about Liber Bank. They had some of the value of its riskiest bonds collapse by 60% in 2 days. I think their share price went down. It was either 20 or 40%. I didn't note that down. And then the government had to introduce a ban on short selling. That's always a sign that things are bad. Short selling is a technique to make money when shares go down. It also pushes the share price down. It shows a lot of people expect that bank to get into trouble. Banning short selling affects the symptom. It doesn't treat the cause at all. But the fact that the government had to step in and do that shows that there are potentials for major problems there. This article then goes on to talk about Unicaja, I guess it is. They had the value of its bonds plunge by 15% in its past week, the Times writes. They write that they're under pressure. They manage 2% of Spain's bank deposits. They're facing nearly 1 billion in subordinated debt repayments in the coming month. So they're under pressure. Meanwhile, in that Banco Popular, junior bondholders were wiped out when Santander took it over. And that's a big step. We're seeing some of the first tests of new banking rules that have been introduced in Europe, where people that have invested money in the bank, even in some cases people who have deposited money in the bank, actually start to lose cash. So when a bank goes bankrupt, it much more quickly affects investors. It much more quickly affects just ordinary people as well, and especially pensioners. The Times quotes one London-based hedge fund saying the bailout of Popular really shocked people. Given that investors in safer bonds were wiped out just as quickly as the more riskier debt, means they're naturally looking for the next weak link. And so that's why a lot of people are nervously looking around at Europe's banks. The Financial Times talked about how it's not just Spanish banks that people are getting very nervous about over this summer. They write that Italy is struggling to rescue a crisis inside two regional banks, Banco Popular di Venezia and Veneto Banca, which are in an even weaker position in terms of capital than Banco Popular, according to a EU official who declined to be identified. Unlike Banco Popular, however, the official said the two Veneto banks lack a willing buyer like Santander. Without a buyer, the banks, which face a combined capital shortfall of 6.4 billion euros, run the risk that regulators would wind them down and impose losses on senior creditors and large depositors, which Banco Popular avoided. So even more ordinary people could be brought into losing money with these banks getting wind down. And when you think of depositors, it would be depositors with more than 100,000 euros is usually the line that's drawn in the bank, which it's easy to think, oh, well, that's only rich people who won't miss the money anyway, when easily that can affect a lot of pensioners and pension funds. Over 100,000 euros isn't a huge amount for a pension at all. But even small businesses, if you're having to pay salaries every month for just 10, 15 people, well, you can quite easily have more than that sitting in the bank. And a lot of small businesses and big businesses lost out in Cyprus when they had something similar. And just the nervousness that that can happen can trigger panic, can trigger financial uncertainty. The Financial Times wrote in a different article that if European authorities in Italy fail to come to agreement by the end of this month, which they failed to do after months of talks, the banks risk being put into resolution, say people directly involved. Matthew Dupont, an academic who is Belgium's representative on the board of the European Central Bank's single supervisory mechanism, says that wiping out deposits as part of a bail-in solution is really very dangerous. So we could see a test of Europe's new banking rules, and if it fails the test, it's something that could become a banking crisis very quickly. We're seeing that banking trouble just continue in Europe and in Spain, in Italy. Maybe they'll be able to plaster it over this time, but there are still major problems there. We'll hear a little more about that in a second. But at the same time, Greece and its economy is in the news. Politico had a piece yesterday, why Greece is Germany's de facto colony. And they wrote that for days, the Greek leader has been working the phones, trying to secure the best possible terms for his country as it enters the last mile of its seemingly endless cycle of bailouts. So far, his efforts have won him more mockery than respect, especially in Germany. They talk about the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, is basically making fun of him. Eurozone finance ministers are set to decide at a meeting in Luxembourg on Thursday, so today, whether to release more than 7 billion of aid to Greece. No one doubts Athens will get the money. Schäuble all but committed to it on Tuesday. But Tsipras wants something even more precious, debt relief. No serious economist believes Greece will ever crawl out from under its more than 300 billion debt without significant forgiveness from its creditors. That means convincing Germany, the country to which Greece owes the most. For much of Greece's nearly decade-long depression, the country was hostage to its domestic politics. Now it is hostage to Germany. Greece is hostage to Germany. It talks about how nobody in Europe really listens to Greece anymore, about how Germany's really made an example of them. You get in line or you end up like Greece, about how Europe, other European countries want to do everything to avoid being in Greece's situation. And they quote the Polish foreign minister saying, Greece is a de facto colony. That's the situation they've ended up in. Now, the Project Syndicate, Kenneth Rogoff, he had a good summary of the situation now. He is a Harvard professor. And here's how he explained where we are and what we're looking at in terms of Europe and the financial crisis right now.
With a reform-minded centrist president elected in France and the re-election of German Chancellor Angela Merkel seeming ever more likely, is there new hope for the stalled single currency project in Europe? In the near term, it looks that way. The Eurozone recovery has outperformed expectations, and the election of Macron has raised hopes that France could become a full partner to Germany in Eurozone governance. But in the long term, it's hard to see how much longer the Euro can trudge on without massively greater political and economic integration. Greece, after more than a 25% drop in per capita income, is still barely growing. Italy's real income is lower than a decade ago, and so forth. For Southern Europe as a whole, the single currency has proved to be a golden cage, forcing greater fiscal and monetary rectitude, but removing the exchange rate and inflation as critical cushions against unexpected shocks. And for what? Bureaucrats have long likened European integration to riding on a bicycle. One must keep moving forward or fall off. If so, the premature adoption of the single currency, which most economists think was never necessary to the EU's success, has been a detour through wet cement. The question now is how to maneuver the EU out of the mire. Although many European politicians are loath to admit it, the status quo is probably not sustainable. The euro is bound to face another major stress test over the next decade, perhaps emanating from China, perhaps a rise in global real interest rates. And the eurozone is nowhere near ready to handle it.
So the eurozone can't survive another major catastrophe. Something has got to change. And as he talked about, though, there could be signs of change coming. France is currently going through its parliamentary elections. They're spread over a couple of days. We had the first round, I think, was a Monday. And then it's the next round next week. And here there's been another shock result. This time it looks like Emmanuel Macron and his brand new political party in France could get a majority in parliament. In the Trumpet print, the latest one I wrote, if Macron does manage to get a majority in parliament in June, he could take strides to reform Germany's economy and possibly even gain popular support for a deal with Germany, a deal that would turn Europe into a superstate. That's absolutely central to Macron's policy. He wants to fix the Eurozone by creating the superstate with a central European tax system, central EU spend system. And he looks like he could have the political clout to start to do that. At the same time, is this banking crisis going to develop into a major crisis? It might. It might not, but as you heard from that video, Europe's just going to keep facing these crises until they make some major changes. So could we now be about to see some of those major changes? Well, they certainly are coming eventually. You can read more about those changes and what's coming in our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. That is about all I've got time for today. That's about it from me. Mr. Stephen Flory, we should be back again tomorrow, so tune in then for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.